Okay. So thanks to Wiesla for inviting me to give a talk today about the new book that I've just published, The Knockoff Economy, which I've co-written with my friend Cal Rostiala. And so what's this book about? Let's go back to the 20th century, and particularly to 1995. So in 1995, Microsoft's one of the biggest companies in the world, and they're flush with cash, and very honorably, they decide that they're going to use a bunch of this cash to do something that is good for the public, which is make an encyclopedia. So they devote a whole bunch of money, they hire a whole bunch of engineers and writers and encyclopedia specialists, and they're going to make an online encyclopedia, which they call Encarta. So you can see a pretty bad image of Encarta on the left. And they're going to have some ads in Encarta and make some money from ads. They're going to write basically an online encyclopedia, and they think they're going to drive the paper encyclopedias out. What they write in this encyclopedia is going to be protected by copyright. So they copyright everything they write, and they put it out into the marketplace. At about the same time, a bunch of people no one had ever heard of start something called Wikipedia. So this is going to be an online encyclopedia. It's going to be created and maintained, edited, curated by volunteers. They have a small staff, but it's mostly volunteers. It's going to be given to people for free. None of what they write is going to be covered by copyright in the traditional sense. They're going to make all the material on Wikipedia available to the public via what's called an open source license. So you're invited, in fact, to copy what's on Wikipedia and to use it on your own website, to spread it around, to distribute it. The only thing they tell you is if you do that, you can't stop other people from doing the same. So if you copy something from Wikipedia, you can't then claim copyright in that material. So you have Microsoft, one of the biggest companies in the world, you know, a juggernaut then, more than now. Incredibly rich, devoting lots and lots of money to an encyclopedia. You have Wikipedia, a bunch of flakes, vaguely communist, you know, having a bunch of volunteers kind of squabble about, you know, whether George W. Bush is a good guy or not. It all sounds like a recipe for disaster. Okay, so that's 95. Think about, you know, 2012. Wikipedia is the only encyclopedia that matters, and Encarta is gone. Right, and the only evidence of Encarta now is the Wikipedia entry on Encarta, which if you read it, takes a fairly triumphalist tone. So what happened here, right? This is interesting. It's interesting, why? Because as always in the law, there is a theory. There's a theory stalking the earth, and the theory goes something like this. So why would anyone create anything when others would be free to copy it, right? So if I am thinking about creating a encyclopedia, I don't want others just copying what I do, because why would I pour the resources into doing that in the first place if people could just copy? If I want to write a song, why would I do that if others could just copy it, right? All the resources that I pour into writing that song, I'm not going to get them back. Why? Because the copyist is going to compete with me. The copyist didn't invest all the time, money, effort, tears, you know, investing in that song in the first place. The copyist just copies it. It's often very easy to copy. If we allow copyists to just do what they do, that will destroy creativity, right? And this is the theory. This is the grounding theory that underlies intellectual property protection in the US, in particular, patent protection and copyright protection. You know, and this goes way back. This is in our Constitution. So in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution, Congress is given the power to vest exclusive rights in authors and inventors for limited times. Why? To promote progress in science and useful arts. Right? So there's a theory that to promote progress in science and useful arts, we need patents and copyrights to prevent copyists from basically grabbing for themselves all the benefits of creativity, and this is the only way we're going to get creativity in the first place. So this is the theory. And the theory sounds good. It sounds like a great theory. It sounds completely commonsensical, and to a certain extent, it's got to be right. And yet there's Wikipedia, right? And it's not just Wikipedia. So this is what Cal and I wanted to do. We wanted to look out into the world, and we wanted to see what was going on in places where the theory doesn't seem to apply. So there are lots of creative areas out there where there's lots of copying, but there's lots of creativity. And often there's lots of copying because for some accidental or maybe historical reason, the patent and copyright laws don't apply. And so people are free to copy, and yet people create. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to tell the story of these industries, what you might call these low IP industries, and see if they have something to say about the theory of IP generally. Now, why do we care about this? We care about it because if you think about what the world's going to be like in 20 years, it's awfully hard to enforce copyrights now. Just ask the music industry, right? So since Napster, their revenues have shrunk by about 60%, adjusted for inflation. The record industry's revenues are imploding. Note, by the way, music's doing great. Even as the record labels implode, music as an art form is thriving. But if copyrights are going to get harder and harder to enforce, then maybe we have something to learn from industries that create all the time without the benefit of copyright or patent, or with limited benefit from copyright and patent. Maybe they have something to teach us about how industries like music or film or book publishing can adjust to a world in which piracy is going to be harder and harder and harder to stop using the law. Okay. So first place Cal and I looked was the fashion industry. Okay, so about $2 trillion a year in commerce around the world, about $200 billion in the US. People think, oh, fashion's silly. It's like it's silly girls buying silly dresses. Fashion is very serious. It's a huge creative industry that is very important both domestically and around the world. And in fashion, there's lots of copying, even though there's lots of creativity. So why is there so much copying? Well, you all know that it's true. I mean, the word knockoff comes from the fashion industry. And in the United States, for the most part, knockoffs are legal. Why are they legal? Because apparel is a useful article, right? It keeps you from freezing to death. It keeps you from being arrested for nakedness. So it's useful. And useful articles are not covered by copyright. Copyrights for artistic and literary things, not useful things. Copyrights for poems, not for cars. Copyrights for movies, not for lamps. And it's not for clothes. You might be able to copyright a fabric pattern, but that has limited relevance in the fashion industry because a lot of the appeal of clothes doesn't come from the fabric pattern. It comes from the shape of the clothes, the cut, the fit. That you're free to copy. Patent doesn't cover clothes because patent only covers things that are novel. There's very little in apparel in fashion that's novel in the way that patent requires. Most clothing is basically a variation on something you've seen before. It's not the true discovery that might be patentable. And even if it is, patent is so expensive and so difficult to get. And the average article of clothing has a lifespan out there in the market of a few months. So the IP system doesn't match up very well. Okay, so very little IP in apparel, very little patent and copyright anyway. It turns out there's a lot of trademark, but that's different, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But there's lots and lots of creativity. So twice a year, in runways around the world, you have models kind of strutting down, and there's new stuff that they're wearing. Hundreds of millions of dollars are invested to bring these new collections to market across the world. All this investment happens, and people can knock it off right away. Right? So how is that possible? That seems to fly in the face of the theory. So Cal and I had a couple of ideas. I'm using these shoes because I went shopping in 2005. I had just been hired here, and I needed some academic clothes. I had a bunch of lawyer clothes. So I went to Nordstrom in Paramus, New Jersey, and there was a table that was full of these shoes. These are driving shoes. And I looked at them for a long time. They all look alike. They're not exactly alike, but they're all coming off the same design. It's a moccasin with a sole that runs up the back made of rubber pebbles. And there's a story behind this. Enzo Ferrari, the famous Ferrari, was driving a sports car around Italy. And he complained to his friend Diego De Valle, a fashion designer, that, you know, when I'm driving my sports car around, I scuff up the back of my moccasins, and that looks, you know, un-Italian. And Diego De Valle said to him, I think I can solve that. And he designed a moccasin with a sole that runs up the back. Thus was born the driving shoe. Okay, so this was popular in the early 80s in, you know, kind of one percenter districts. So like the Upper East Side, you saw people walking around in these, and then they went away. Until 2005, when they came back en masse, right? So I'm standing in the Nordstrom, and there's a dozen and a half or so pairs of these arrayed around the table. There's a pair by Echo. There's a pair by Minnetonka, kind of Native American version made in deer skin of the driving shoe. There's the Ralph Lauren version in green, which is, you know, for people who, I guess, wear white belts and drive gigantic powerboats. You know, there's a version for everybody, right? And if copyright law applied, you couldn't do this. Copyright law doesn't just prohibit exact copying. It prohibits any substantial similarity. So these shoes would be copyright infringing for the most part if copyright applied. But it doesn't, because these are useful articles. They cover your feet. They allow you to walk without hurting yourself. Right? Copyright doesn't apply. So what is the fashion industry doing here? Actually, they're turning copying to their advantage. Why? Well, think about it. Why you buy clothes. Right? Why was I buying clothes? Not because my clothes had worn out, but because I needed clothes in a different style, right? And copies, right, help to sell fashion in a world where people buy a lot of clothes just because of the style. So copies help set trends. How do we know a trend exists? A popular design is copied relentlessly, and we recognize all those copies together as a trend. Trends sell apparel, right? As Shakespeare said a long time ago, the apparel, the trend or the style, he said, wears out more apparel than the man. So copying helps set trends, right? And then copying helps kill trends. When the trend is overcopied, the early adopters, the fashionistas, say, well, this is overdone, and they jump off. And at the moment they jump off, copying is setting the new trend. Right? So copying, in a sense, is the fuel that drives the trend cycle. Copying is not the enemy of creativity in fashion. Copying is the fuel of creativity in fashion. It's the thing that drives consumption and that makes the fashion markets as big and lucrative as they are. If it weren't for copying and it weren't for trends, our clothes wouldn't go out of style so quickly. We'd stay the same for longer, right? And for those of us that care at all about style, and of course that's not all of us, but for those who do, this is a fact of life. Copying helps drive us to buy the new thing. Now, is that good for society? I really don't know. I'll note that, you know, if we weren't, you know, competing for status by wearing stylish clothes, we'd be competing for status by getting graduate degrees. I'm not sure that's better. That just creates a bunch of boring cocktail party conversation. But, you know, such as it is, the industry benefits from all this copying, right? Trends get set, trends get killed. New trends get set. Copying's at the root of all of it. There's another thing that we notice, and again, I'll explain it with shoes, and all the shoes have gone away. I'm not sure why. Okay, lower right is a Christian Louboutin platform pump. How do you know it's Louboutin? Because there's this red outsole, right? That's a trademark. Can't copy that. But if this slide were functioning correctly, you would see lots and lots of versions of this Louboutin platform pump that appeared very quickly after the Louboutin version came out, right? The Louboutin version had wide appeal. Shoemakers started to copy it. Now, not just copy it perfectly, but spin out varieties of it, right? Derivative works. And what message is the fashion industry sending when they do this? Well, one, that a trend is being set. We covered that. But here's another one. They're sending a message to a woman who's looking to buy shoes that this shoe is in style. It's socially acceptable to wear this shoe at this time. It's, in a sense, using copying to lower a woman's information costs of getting dressed. Right? Information costs just a variety of transaction cost. And if you think about it from the fashion industry's point of view, they want us to buy clothes. We're more likely to buy them if we know that they're appropriate, right? That they fit the trend that we want to be within. And by copying, this sends a very strong message that this fits the trend, right? That this is something that you can wear now. Information costs go down, our consumption goes up. Right? It's a kind of basic point about markets. When markets have lower transaction costs, they're more lucrative. Right? So this is a benefit of copying, again, that the fashion industry realizes. So fashion. Anything else? Well, an even bigger industry, food. So several thousand years ago in Greece, in the city-state of Sybaris, right, you can see what word that gave us, there was an intellectual property system, we think. It's the first intellectual property system we know anything about. And it covered one thing. And that was, if you came up with a good recipe, you could go to some committee and you could have them taste it. And if they liked it, they'd give you a one-year exclusive right to cook it within the city walls. Now, why did they do this? Because the Sybarites loved luxury, especially in cookery. They wanted new recipes. And they had the same theory in mind that I talked about earlier. If we allow copyists, who would engage in recipe creation in the first place? well, since the Sybarites, basically nobody else has copyright in recipes. We don't have copyright in recipes. Why? Because recipes are just a collection of facts, milk, eggs, bread, flour, and processes, boil, bake, fry, stir. Facts are not copyrightable or patentable. Processes are not copyrightable. Processes might be patentable, but boiling's been around for a while. So it's in the public domain. You can't. There's nothing novel about boiling something or frying it or stirring it, right? Maybe if you have some weird molecular cookery technique, like zapping something with a laser in liquid nitrogen or something, maybe that gets patented. But for the most part, cookery procedures, methods, not patentable. And so food, again, lives in a very low IP zone. Recipes especially live in a no IP zone. And prepared food as well. So when you actually prepare the recipe, you can't copyright the food on the plate. You cannot patent it. And yet, again, the bookstores are groaning under the weight of new cookbooks, despite the fact that you can buy a cookbook or, you know, just take a photo of a page and, you know, scan that in and post that to, you know, your website. It's perfectly legal. There's no copyright violation from doing that, posting the recipe itself. Maybe if you post the photographs, the copyrighted photographs in the cookbook, that's a problem. But the recipe itself is not covered by copyright. Now, how on earth do we get so much creativity in cookery without any IP? Well, there are a few answers. And to do this, think of the molten chocolate cake. Okay, so Jean-Georges Vongerichten is said to have invented this. And of course, as people liked it, it spread around, right? And now you can get a molten chocolate cake at Chili's. And in fact, the recipe for the Chili's molten chocolate cake is on the web, right? So how does that happen? How does creativity keep going when you get so much copying? Okay, so a few things. There's a bunch of research out there, well, a little bit of research out there now documenting the norms of chefs, right? So chefs aren't bound by legal rules like copyright in that protect their recipes, but they get some protection from the social practices of the group that they live in, right? So there's a study, for example, looking at high-end Parisian chefs. And what's pretty clear from this study is that they don't mind people copying them as long as they get attribution. So I don't mind the recipe being copied, the chef says, as long as the copyist says, I got this from X on the menu, right? But if copying is done without attribution, they retaliate, right? So now they no longer talk to the offender. They won't share ingredients with the offender. They won't share cooking secrets or the location of a good fish, right? So they starve them for information. There are community sanctions for people who don't adhere to the norm. And the norm isn't so much an anti-copying norm, it's an attribution norm. You may copy from me, but name me. Now, why would that be? So there's some other research on chefs that suggests that what's really important to them is their reputation. At least at the high end, the kind of chefs who do the creating, right, the true artists in the field, they care a lot about their reputation as innovators. And why? Because when it comes to the decision of a one percenter to spend a whole lot of money on a meal, it's one thing to go to a restaurant that does excellent execution of classic dishes. People are willing to pay for that. But people are willing to pay more for great execution of new dishes, right? The jaded palate of the one percenter is looking for something new, and a reputation for inventive cookery is a valuable thing. So the norms about attribution, right, give me attribution, this is meant to feed in to a reputation for innovation, right? The fact that my great recipe is being cooked at the restaurant down the street and I'm being credited for it is tremendously valuable to me as an innovative chef. Now, you know, Jean-Georges Vongerichten doesn't get credited for all the molten chocolate cakes at every corner bistro. But to the extent that foodies, people who really love food, know, and foodies know, that something as kind of seminal as the molten chocolate cake is Vongerichten's invention, that cements him in the firmament of great chefs. Another thing, which is more a broader point about how cuisine works, so you can think of the recipe as a product, right? But the restaurant industry doesn't just depend on that product. It depends a lot on a performance. So what do I mean by that? Well, think of the recipe as like the download, easy to copy. Think of the restaurant as like the live show, not easy to copy, right? You go see a band live, that experience has to do with the performance. The performance is not easy to copy. You can take a cell phone video and put it on YouTube, but it's not the same. When you go to a restaurant, there's execution of the recipe. there's the decor, there's the crowd, the excitement of the crowd. There's the, you know, the wait staff and their excellence, the way they're dressed. You know, if you're in LA, they're all models. There's a lot of things about the restaurant that are performance, right? That are the way, the entire experience that surrounds the execution of the recipe. These things are really hard to copy, right? So to a certain extent, the restaurant industry is just inherently insulated against the effects of copying by what they do. Just note that that's possibly a lesson, right? The music industry is as plagued by piracy as it is, in part because they focus on the product, right? Imagine a music industry that focuses more on the performance. That's what you're starting to see, right? So the live element of the music industry is doing well. The product element, the CD element, or the download element, is doing poorly. The music industry isn't dying. The profits are shifting around. Why are the record companies so annoyed about that? Because they don't own the live music part of the business. Live Nation, a dominant firm, actually. I'm not quite sure how the antitrust division let that happen. But Live Nation, a dominant firm, owns a huge part of the live end of the industry. They're doing great. Right? The record labels are doing pretty poorly. But on the whole, the revenues from music are shifting, like in the restaurant industry, away from product and toward performance. We don't have a ton of time, and I want to leave some time for questions. But let me play you a couple of songs, because I want to just talk about something that's right under our noses, and we don't even think about it as knockoffs. Rodgers and Hammerstein, right? Wait, whoa, stop. Rodgers and Hammerstein, okay? And Rodgers and Hammerstein. So how does John Coltrane get to do that, right? Because you know it's not just John Coltrane. I just assembled last night a list of knockoffs, which of course now I can't find. But you know there are tons of musical knockoffs, and that's what this is, right? These are musical knockoffs. They happen to be legal, right? So how is it that they're legal? Well, there's a story, and like a lot of things in this area, it's kind of weird, right? It's an accident that musical knockoffs are legal. It has to do with a company called Aeolian. So more than 100 years ago, think back actually to the mid-19th century. Before then, the only way you ever experienced music was actually in the air at a live performance, right? So you went to see an orchestra, or you looked at it on sheet music, right? You looked at it on paper. That's the only way music actually existed. There was no way to mechanically reproduce it. The first way to mechanically reproduce music was the player piano. A business dominated by a company called Aeolian, which actually disappeared in 1985. But back in the mid to late 19th century was like the Microsoft of its day. So Aeolian made player pianos, and they also vertically integrated into the provision of the software for these machines, which is player piano rolls, right? You can see the roll up there. It's a scroll of paper with holes punched in it. And this is just computer software. This is just a mechanical computer. And all the roll is doing is it's instructing the mechanical computer which keys to depress on the piano to replay any particular musical composition. So what Aeolian did was they went around buying up the copyrights for a lot of popular musical compositions, and they would not license these to anyone. They basically held themselves out as the exclusive piano roll manufacturer for a whole bunch of popular compositions. So you could only play this song if you bought an Aeolian player piano, right? Pretty familiar strategy. So Aeolian at one point gets sued by a bunch of songwriters, because in some cases, they made player piano rolls for songs without even licensing the copyrights. They get sued by the songwriters. This gets all the way up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says, no copyright violation. Why? Because they looked at the player piano roll and they couldn't understand it. So they said, this isn't copying the song. I mean, duh. Yeah, it is. It's copying the song in a language the machine understands, right? But be that as it may, about a year later, Congress overturns the Supreme Court's decision. They say, you know, reproductions of songs that a machine can understand is a copy for copyright purposes, and they extend copyright to these mechanical reproductions. But in doing so, they have Aeolian in mind. Because what they don't want to do, what Congress doesn't want to do, is license an Aeolian monopoly. And so they say, although copyright does extend to these mechanical reproductions, any person who wishes to make a mechanical reproduction can do so. They just have to pay the copyright owner 2 cents per copy. That was the rule. Some of you will recognize that this is a liability rule, right? Whereas copyright and patent mostly lays out property rules, right? The right to enjoin someone from using your copyright or your patent. This is a liability rule. You can't say no. You get paid 2 cents a copy, but you can't say no. Right? So that's why Jimi Hendrix can make a cover of Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower. Right? That's why No Doubt can cover Talk Talk's It's My Life, right? I mean, and there's a million of these, right? This is a big part of our musical culture and some of our best musical culture. John Coltrane, some of his best work is him taking other people's songs like this one and spinning it out a completely different direction. I mean, darker, more contemplative, deeper. You know, he takes a great pop song and turns it into something truly great, right? So this is a huge fountain of creativity that happens because of this, right? This weird historical accident. So I ask you, do we have a collapse in people's willingness to write songs? No, right? This is a songwriting culture. We are the world's songwriters along with the Brits. We write a lot of songs, right? We have a thriving musical culture. Despite the fact that the 2 cents per copy, Congress didn't touch that for 100 years. And then when they touched it, they bumped it up to 9 cents per copy. But when you factor in inflation, the 9 cents per copy that it is today is worth about 15% what the 2 cents per copy was when they first put it in. So they got literally pennies, and those pennies have since eroded to virtually nothing. So it's basically free to take somebody else's song and make a knockoff. And yet, songwriters write songs, right, in every genre at an incredible clip, right? We're drowning in them. I finally want to talk about stand-up comedy and then open it up to some questions. So there's a little bit different story here, and this comes from some research that I did with Dotan Oliar, who also is here at the law school, a couple of years ago. We published an academic paper on this, and Cal and I have talked about some of the findings of that paper in this book. So again, copyright doesn't really play much of a role in stand-up comedy, even though stand-up comics have a significant worry that rival comics are going to steal their jokes. Right? So if you think back in the history of comedy, to say the 1940s and 1950s, right? The first stand-ups really that we recognize as stand-ups, these are people who came on the scene after the collapse of vaudeville, right? So vaudeville's kind of a variety show format that dominated American entertainment up through the 1930s. Vaudeville collapses, and the MCs who were in charge of the vaudeville show kind of step away from the vaudeville show, and they have their own act now, and these became stand-up comedies, stand-up comedians. So in the early days of stand-up comedy, in the post-vaudeville era, there was something called the corn exchange, which is comedians stole each other's jokes really, you know, enthusiastically. Milton Berle, who was one of the leading post-vaudeville stand-ups, one of the one-liner guys, would often get up on stage and he would say, you know, the guy who came before me was great, so funny that I almost dropped my pad and pencil. Right? This was a kind of a norm among comedians of that day, that jokes were essentially public property. People took them. Sometimes they paid for them, sometimes they didn't. It wasn't even really thought of as stealing. It was termed the corn exchange. Okay, and then something weird happened. Comedians started asserting ownership in their jokes, but they didn't do so by filing copyright lawsuits. There are no copyright lawsuits of comedians suing their rivals. You can't find any, at least since 1911. In 1911, there was one that kind of looks like that, although stand-up comedy as a form didn't really exist in 1911, so it's hard to know what to make of it. But since then, definitely nothing. Why no lawsuits? Well, copyright's a really crummy protection for jokes, right? Why? Well, copyright doesn't protect ideas. Often it's the idea behind a joke that makes it funny. And if you take that funny idea and express it slightly differently, you're out from under copyright. So that's not very effective protection. And even if the joke sounds exactly like the joke that the plaintiff told, the defendant can just say, I didn't copy it, I made it up myself, which is often, in fact, true. If you think of a lot of political humor, for example, a lot of it's driven by stuff in the news, and a lot of people in the comedy community come to roughly the same jokes at roughly the same time, and so it's actually hard to prove copying, right? So copyright's a really tough strategy for comedians, and they haven't resorted to it. What they've done instead is they've ginned up a set of informal anti-copying norms, kind of like chefs, only the rules are different. Chefs really care about attribution, they care about being named. They're fine with copying if they're named. Comedians don't care about being named. They don't want copying. They have very strong anti-copying intuitions, and these are expressed in their norms. So how does this work? Comedians spend a lot of time in each other's company because they perform on comedy bills 5, 6, even 10 at a time in a night, and they watch each other very carefully. And when they see a comedian doing some bit that they think is the property of a friend or maybe their own property, they confront them, right? There was a famous confrontation on stage at the Laugh Factory in Los Angeles not too long ago between Joe Rogan and Carlos Mencia, where Joe Rogan gets up in Carlos Mencia's face and accuses him of stealing jokes from a friend. This is an example of what happens behind closed doors a lot. Confrontation, which often leads to settlements. Okay, I'll drop it. Or I'll only tell it on the West Coast because I know you focus on the East Coast. Something like this, right? And if you think about it, that's the way a lot of intellectual property disputes get settled. They get settled, not litigated. But if there's no settlement, then there are punishments. Often this is limited to bad mouthing, right? But bad mouthing, it turns out, has a pretty big effect, both because comedians are expert bad mouthers and because it sucks going to work every night and having people stare daggers into you. I mean, Robin Williams in a Playboy magazine interview said, you know, I gave up stand-up comedy because people accused me of stealing jokes, and I would go to the comedy club, and these people would be staring at me and saying nasty things to me, and who needs that crap? Like, I couldn't take it, right? So bad-mouthing is surprisingly effective, but if the bad-mouthing doesn't work, the second step is essentially a group boycott, right? So comedians band together, and they refuse to work on a comedy bill with the comedian they view as the thief. And for comedians who aren't at the very top of the profession, this can be extremely damaging, right? This limits the kind of jobs they can get. It's a disciplining mechanism that actually has quite a bit of teeth. If that's not enough, occasionally comedians will beat each other up, right? So you get comedians punching other comedians in the mouth over a stolen joke. This doesn't happen often. It's obviously not a good thing. But it happens occasionally, and this is private violence to back up a private norm system. It's not the law. In fact, it's illegal. But it's a kind of IP. Right. Now, let's think again about the theory. And I'll close with this, and I'm going to show you a couple of videos, and you can tell me what you think. So the theory is that if we get lots of copying, we don't get a lot of creativity. Back in the post-vaudeville age, the 40s, the 50s, we had lots of copying. We also had lots of comedy, lots of jokes, lots of new material. And then after the norm system, we have a lot less copying. And we have a lot of creativity. We have a lot of jokes, we have a lot of new material. I have a hard time believing that the growth of the property rules, even though they're informal property rules, they're still property rules, that the growth of the property rules gave us more comedy. But I'm going to play you a couple of clips, and I think you'll see something else that it contributed to. Maybe not more. Okay. Here's Henny Youngman, a post-vaudeville comedian.
Luggage is an Edward, there's piece of luggage, they go to Cleveland. I want this piece of luggage to go to Miami. He said, we can't do that, or you did it last week. The food on the plane was tit for a king. Hey, king, hey, king. Any Italians here tonight? I love the Italian people. During World War II, an Italian girl saved my life. She hid me in her cellar. It was in Cleveland. About four people on the floor walks up to me and says, I haven't eaten in 2 days. I said, you should force yourself.
Henny Youngman. There's a great Henny Youngman joke which I won't tell. A very different comedian. And a modern one, not a post-vaudeville comedian, but one who's with us today. So this is totally horrible, as Sarah Silverman often is. I don't mean not funny, but totally insane. Don't blame me. Don't shoot the messenger.
I'm not a hoity-toity kind of girl. I don't wear any jewelry. I'm not into jewelry or anything. I'm such a hypocrite. There's a jewel that I think is, I'm gonna sound like such a jack. There is one jewel that I think is stunning, that it's just like a classic, and it's just, and by Jap, I mean Japanese. But it's gorgeous, and it's really, it's rare. It's only found like on the tip of the tailbone of Ethiopian babies. They debone the baby. I know that sounds so bad when you say it out loud. No, if you saw it, so worth it. I don't even describe it like if a diamond had that newborn baby smell. I have a moral issue with it, obviously, because they're treating the unions really bad. Your battles, I guess. So cute.
Okay. So what's the difference between, there's a lot of differences between Henny Youngman and Sarah Silverman, but what's the difference that might relate to the growth of the IP norms? Anyone have a view on this? Yeah.
It would be relatively simple to steal Henny Youngman.
Yeah, very simple, right? Because they're interchangeable jokes. They kind of range over a whole bunch of topics. What about Sarah Silverman's? That's exactly right. So it's much harder to steal Sarah Silverman's jokes, because to do it, you'd have to establish her persona. Her jokes make sense within the framework of a character that she spends a tremendous amount of time on stage informing you about. So the Sarah Silverman who is probably sitting in her living room right now counting her money is, probably a perfectly nice person. The Sarah Silverman on stage is a monster, right? But a very particular monster. She has really interesting character attributes. She's not stupid, but she's completely morally blind, right? And she's also completely unwilling to kind of curb her, I don't know, honesty. It's a weird character, but it's a pretty well fleshed out character, and her narrative really comes from that character, and it makes sense when it's spun out by that character, and it's in a sense trademarked in that it comes kind of along with indicia of source, right? The way that swoosh on your sneaker says this is a Nike, there are things that are a lot more subtle, that what the joke's about, the way it's told, that are indicia of Sarah Silverman, right? So why is that? Well, I think back in the days of the Corn Exchange, when jokes were kind of passed around, it made sense that jokes were relatively interchangeable. It made sense that they were generic. If they were stolen, no big deal. There wasn't a huge amount of investment in them in the first place. Plus, you were going to steal next week. There was a great deal of reciprocity. So less originality, but you know, the kind of form fit the legal rule. Here, there's a lot more originality. Now, I'm not saying that the norm system created this. There are other cultural, you know, changes that created humor like we have today. You know, in the 60s, just the focus on individuality really is evident in stand-up comedy from Lenny Bruce on, right? These are personal stories that people are telling. They're not jokes. Not in the same way, anyway. So alongside that cultural shift, we get the shift in legal rules that I talked about. Now, it's not a shift in legal rules that copyright law changes. Congress doesn't touch the copyright law in a way that's relevant to comedians. What changes are comedians' norms that enforce a kind of private copyright law. And as they do so, they reinforce a way of creating that allows the norm system to do its work. So when Sarah Silverman creates her material, she knows that other comedians have her back. And I bet on the margin, and comedians told Dotonomy that on the margin, they design their material to make it easier for their fellow comedians to police on their behalf, right? So if someone tells a Sarah Silverman joke, one of her fellows is probably going to see this is a Sarah Silverman joke because of the indicia of Sarah Silvermanness that accompanies it, and they'll report it. Right? And then the norm system can do its work. So the kind of comedy we get is tied to the kind of legal rule we have. So to close the loop, the theory here is kind of weird. It's not that we get more. It's that we get different, right? We get a different kind of cultural expression. And that makes the policy upshot very different than what we started out with. So the theory says, well, the reason we care about property rights is because we need these property rights to incentivize creativity. We don't, if comedy tells us anything, need the property rights to incentivize creativity. We get comedic creativity either way. We need the property rights to incentivize a particular kind of comedic creativity. Now that leads to the next question. Do you like this particular type of comedic creativity? Do you like Henny Youngman's humor or Sarah Silverman's? So just speaking for myself, I like Sarah Silverman's, but that's just me, right? There are arguments to be made for Henny Youngman's. Sarah Silverman's is more inventive, but it's less communal, right? Henny Youngman's jokes are the kind of jokes you tell to your mother or that you tell to other people, period. You don't tell Sarah Silverman jokes, right? You don't retail Sarah Silverman jokes the way you retail one-liners from the Henny Youngman era. Humor serves a different social function now than it used to. Humor used to be a communal activity. It used to be peer-to-peer. Now humor is one-to-many, right? Even though I like Sarah Silverman's humor, I like the peer-to-peer nature of the humor we had. So if we want more of that, then we want less IP. If we want more of the humor we have, then we're content with more IP that we have. Even though the IP is informal, it's very effective. That's a question that isn't really a lawyer question or an economist question. This is a people question. What culture do we like? What culture is good for us? What do we want? Not how much do we get? Okay, I'm going to stop there.